Hello, folks. Welcome to the December 25th, 2010 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois. Webcast worldwide at WFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here during this hour program, those of the speaker, do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management or board of directors. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, a joyful Kwanzaa to everybody. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today. Oh, and also a happy Saturnalia, Tom.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm your host, David Johnson, today with co-host Tom Thomas, who has some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week is entitled Revel in the Unity. And you'll hear it here first on the Illinois World Labor Hour. And also here with us today is Bill Gorell, co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, and very special guest, Jim Iman. Who's also a co-host of the television show on Public Access TV, Labor's Worldview. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thank you very much. I've not been on in a couple of months or so.
Oh, it's been a while. Yes.
Yeah, even maybe three. But I'm happy to be here. I hope the audience is happy to hear my voice. I'm playing Grinch today.
Yes, I was just going to say, they may not be happy with what you have to say on the show today, yeah, but this will be an interesting show.
Well, and I'm going to compete with Bill, so
okay,
stand by.
Okay, looking forward to that. Okay, so here's Tom to kick off this week's workers' interest news.
The Republicans won big in the fall elections, and as they prepare to take over state houses around the country, are proposing to cut corporate taxes, to weaken union clout, and to rewrite laws on discrimination, whistleblowers, and injured workers to the benefit of the employers. Basically, they intend to push through a plantation owner's dream list, and they plan to press ahead even though their ideas are ultimately going to cost their states desperately needed tax revenues. When the new wave of politicians takes office in January, the Republicans will hold a majority of state governorships and their greatest number of state legislators since 1928, just a year before the Great Depression destroyed every national economy in the Western world. In the 2010 election, voters were concerned about the high unemployment and an economy struggling to regain life after the most recent Republican-initiated recession. The Republican pro-business policies are only theories and have not been clearly proven to create any kinds of jobs yet. And if they do work in the long run, and it will be a very long, long run, cash-strapped states may begin to catch up. All that we as citizens can do is wait and see. Is the GOP going to give it to us or just continue to stick it to us?
Okay, I got a story here from South Africa. On Wednesday, the 20th of October, the workers of the Mine Line TAP engineering factory in Krugersdorp, just outside Soweto, started an occupation of their workplace to stop the former owner from stripping the factory of machinery and other assets and to fight to save their jobs. The workers are organized by the Metal and Electrical Workers Union of South Africa, in which the Democratic Socialist Movement, the sister party, the Socialist Party, plays a leading role. They are occupying the plant and mobilizing a mass solidarity campaign demanding state takeover of the factory so that it can be reopened as a democratically run workers' cooperative. Mine Line Tap Engineering, which produces valves, locomotives, etc. for the mining industry, was shut down in August as the owner, Mr. Mulder, was trying to escape responsibility for the deaths of three workers in a August 4th accident caused by his gross disregard for workers' health and safety. Despite the economic crisis, Mine Line has remained a viable business. The insolvency is the direct result of Mulder's criminal looting, fraud, and theft. He took $15 million in cash from the company account in addition to the fleet of luxury cars and helicopters he had bought himself with company money and filed for bankruptcy the following day. While he's since been colluding with the liquidator, Commonwealth Trust, to loot the company, sealing its funds to set up business elsewhere, the 107 workers and the families of the workers who were killed are left with nothing to show for, in most cases over 25 years of service. Workers decided on Wednesday, the 20th of October, to guard the premises to stop the ex-owner and the liquidator from stealing any more machinery or other assets from the factory. Workers are fighting to save jobs, pensions, and benefits, but also to show that production and society in general can be run without the capitalist bosses. The workers are demanding that the state should transfer ownership to the workers and inject capital to revive the business, and are forming a cooperative to run the factory as it steps towards the nationalization of the company under workers' control and management.
It looks as if one of Illinois' ex-gangster governors is not going to get that Christmas present he was hoping for. A federal judge upheld George Ryan's convictions and denied his request to be released from prison on bond. U.S. District Judge Rebecca Palmeyer issued the 58-page ruling after Ryan's attorneys argued that parts of his conviction should be tossed based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision curtailing anti-fraud laws. Palmeyer ruled that while the Supreme Court case was relevant, Ryan's circumstances were different enough that his convictions should stand. The 76-year-old former governor has served 3 years of a 6.5-year sentence on convictions of racketeering, conspiracy, tax fraud, and making false statements to the FBI. His current release date will be in 2013. Former Governor James R. Thompson, one of Ryan's attorneys, said lawyers would be appealing the ruling as quickly as they could. An appeals court could grant Ryan bail, but Thompson noted that every decision so far has gone against him.
You know, it's interesting that once George Ryan was being investigated, the last, I don't know, year or two of his governorship, he actually did some halfway decent things, surprisingly. I mean, he put that moratorium on any more executions in the state of Illinois.
Yeah,
and he also took a trip to Cuba and advocated for the dropping of the United States embargo against Cuba that would actually help the Illinois agricultural community, if you would. So I don't know. Maybe it was opportunistic, but.
Well, I don't know. this bill. Where he was facing some prison time, he may have wanted to get a little
karma
suck
on
with the other inmates, you know. By I wouldn't want you to be executed.
You know, I never thought of that, Bill. That's an interesting perception there.
And there's another one too that I've noticed, and this came up. Somebody, a Facebook friend of mine, put up a segment of a documentary. Frontline documentary. About Lee Atwater.
Mm-hmm.
And we might remember Lee Atwater, just before he died, renounced what he had done politically.
Mm-hmm.
And you might remember last couple of weeks, Richard Holbrook.
Oh, yes.
When his last words, and I hope there was somebody there besides a Pakistani doctor, because that kind of puts a cloud on it.
Mm-hmm.
But Richard Holbrook's last words were, "You have to get us out of Afghanistan."
Really?
Yes, that was his last words, I believe.
You know, they tried.
He did say that anyway.
Of course, the corporate media and our so-called public, airwaves, I should say, you know, PBS, NPR, you know, just had this glowing account about how he was such a great diplomat and everything. Guy was a war criminal. He was a war criminal. He was directly responsible for the deaths of over a 250,000 East Timorese during the 1970s.
Correct.
And he was also responsible for instigating the war in Yugoslavia. You know, that's a really interesting topic because most people out there, even a lot of people on the so-called left, don't know the real story behind that war in Yugoslavia. I mean, basically, it was a successful campaign to destroy a non-market economy, basically a socialist economy. Yugoslavia during the Cold War was a neutral, country that basically didn't prevent its citizens from immigrating like the Eastern Bloc did, the Warsaw Pact. They had access, the citizens of Yugoslavia had access to all sorts of Western books and publications, and they had workers' councils and all the state-owned factories and stuff. And, you know, so it wasn't a typical Stalinistic country. You know?
There was one thing about that situation that is that we are not entirely racist. We will bomb white people, too.
Oh, that's...
Even though they're the, you know, those Eastern Europe. that aren't quite really Europeans, you know.
Yeah, they were part of the Ottoman Empire, I know. But,
but the reason I brought that up about, because it was sort of like those were George Ryan sort of in a social way, his last words. Mm-hmm. It's really funny how when people kind of get down in that type of a situation where all of a sudden everything that they've done their entire lives to screw everybody in the world over, even though they've been out spending their entire lives talking about how great these things are and necessary or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then at the end, then they'll do what's actually reasonable.
Yeah.
I was listening to that Bill Moyers sing on the way in, and the plutocracy and the plutonomy, and I don't know.
Okay, Tom.
Back to the news.
The Menard State Penitentiary opened in 1878 and still does not have electric locks. Guards have to use keys and crank a heavy wheel to open individual rows of cells, and the guards at the facility, which is about 60 miles south of St. Louis, are saying they're suffering from numbness in their hands and arms as a result of physical stress. An Illinois Department of Corrections spokesman announced that installing electronic locks would be far too expensive. However, workers at the Menard Correctional Center received more than $1.5 million in workers' compensation settlements for injuries to their hands, wrists, and elbows. Guards say the injuries were caused by repetitive actions like locking and unlocking cells with the old-fashioned locks. According to public records from the Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission, taxpayer-funded settlements to individual recipients range from $22,000 to $120,000. 55 prison workers have applied for compensation, 51 of them actual guards at the maximum security facility, which amounts to one in every 10 officers employed there. Menard employees also have received more than $195,000 in missed work payments. One Illinois lawmaker, State Senator Kyle McCarter of Lebanon, reported he is concerned about the claims. McCarter said, "We have to take a strong stand against fraud while helping out workers who are legitimately hurt on the job."
San Francisco's local hire ordinance bill is the toughest in the country will become law after Mayor Gavin Newsom on Thursday declined to veto the measure. Newsom returned the legislation to the Board of Supervisors unsigned, saying he has reservations about parts of it and wants the city to pursue reciprocity agreements with neighboring counties. Because his moves were short of a veto, the measure will go into effect starting in 2011. Local hire policy is a complex arena that operates on a delicate balance, Newsom wrote in his letter. Even if Newsom had tried to kill the measure, his veto probably would have been overturned. A veto-proof majority of the board had approved the measure earlier this month on an 8-3 vote. Under the ordinance introduced by Supervisor John Avalos, city contractors and subcontractors working on city-funded construction projects worth $400,000 or more would have to ensure that at least 20% of the workers live in San Francisco during the first year the mandate becomes effective. The local worker requirement increases 5 percentage points every year until it hits the 50% mark in 7 years. Contractors who fail to meet the requirement will face financial penalties. The San Mateo County Board of Supervisors and other peninsula officials called on Newsom to veto the measure, saying it will hurt workers there. The economic recession has no boundaries, said Assemblyman Rich Gordon, whose district includes much of the peninsula and Silicon Valley. If local governments choose to tackle their challenges through myopic self-interest, regional problems relating to employment, the environment, education, transportation will not be solved. It's interesting because I don't know how many workers are left in the city of San Francisco, truthfully. I mean, it's become such a gentrified playground for millionaires and billionaires. I mean, we've got friends who live out in the Bay Area, and most working class people live over in Oakland, you know.
Somebody has to service them, David.
Well, that's right, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, San Francisco's got so expensive unless you've bought a house, you know, back, you know, before the late or sometime before the early mid.
Well, hell, Dave, could you afford the property taxes after it?
That's right.
I tell you what, that's something that's killing a lot. It's working people. It's a big problem I have. And it is so unfair, you know, to bring in something else. And it has to do with the fundings of the schools. I work with people from Vermilion County quite often. And I don't know all the details about their property or whatever, but I would assume it might be somewhere comparable to mine. They're paying like less than $500 a year in property taxes, man, in Piatt County. And I guess it's just because we have such great services in Piatt County.
Not.
I don't know how to compare them.
Yeah.
The Piatran thing's pretty cool, even though they did buy a foreign vehicle the other day. But anyway, let's get into something else. But I don't understand why my property taxes are over $1,300.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
There's people living in the city of Champaign, like in my old neighborhood between Hessel Park and John Street. I mean, it's not the best neighborhood in Champaign, that's for sure. And there's people there, you know, working class people have like 2-3 bedroom houses. They're paying like $2,500 a year.
Yeah, I have a 1 bedroom house. The biggest thing is I have 1 acre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and oh yeah, here's a good one. They did that one year, that a couple of years ago, that jumped up by 60% on yeah. just the property, the land. I call them about that, and they said, "Well, that hadn't been raised for 20 years."
So they had.
Well,
to,
what?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really that's tax issues. I mean, this is where the unions are really falling down, man. Tax issues are a working person's issue.
They are,
and they don't do anything about it. I am so sick of Samuel Gompers's simple unionism. It is simple.
No, simple-minded.
Yeah, I mean, it is. They don't realize all these things. Abortion is a workers' issue. Global warming is a workers' issue. Every issue that is a workers' issue, and they don't. I'm so frustrated.
Yes, indeed. I know the feeling, Bill. Anyway, we're going to listen to a little Jim Hightower here, and then we're going to be back with Tom Thomas's poem of the week, and then we're going to get into this really interesting discussion with our friend and comrade Jim Iman.
Guess who's whining the loudest these days? Wailing that they're getting a raw deal from Barack Obama. Not the unemployed and barely employed. Even though the White House has blithely ignored their critical need for a national jobs program. Not the poor, even though their ranks are swelling as millions of Americans fall out of the middle class. No, no. The most insistent demand for attention is coming from way above the poor and the middle class. Believe it or not, it's the CEOs of America's biggest corporations and the top bankers of Wall Street who are stamping their little Gucci-clad feet, bawling that they should be getting more love and support from the president. It seems that the feelings of these precious ones have been hurt by Obama's occasional condemnation of the stupefying greed that's been shown by the likes of health insurance executives and Wall Street banksters. As one CEO put it, Obama's attitude felt too much like we were the bad guys. Yoo-hoo, Mr. Multimillionaire Executive, you are. Corporate chieftains are ruthlessly downsizing the middle class, carelessly polluting our air and water, gleefully destroying our democracy by using their corrupting corporate money to buy our government, and generally feeling entitled to run roughshod over everyone, all while pocketing obscene levels of wealth for themselves. Yet they're the ones crying? This is Jim Hightower saying, these guys are pathetic. They're a bunch of narcissists with a perverse sense of entitlement. Obama ought to send each of them a box of Kleenex and tell them to go to hell. But unfortunately, he's no Harry Truman, so instead, he's giving in to them. I intend to make clear to the business community, he recently announced, that the most important thing we can do is to boost and encourage our business sector. Hello, they're doing fine. They're not the ones hurting. They're doing the hurting. The most important thing you can do is to boost America's middle class. Here, ho, ho, ho! It's gift-giving season again. And I always like to present special gifts at the end of the year to some of America's power elites, just to show them that I'm always thinking about them. My presents this year are not products, but some of the important human qualities that they seem to lack. Let's start with Wall Street's top bankers, who've taken huge bailouts from us taxpayers, yet still refuse to invest in the productive, job-creating enterprises that our country desperately needs, even as they lavish multimillion-dollar bonuses on themselves. So I'm sending something to each of them that money can't buy, great big bottles of humility. Please, drink deeply. Now, for those congressional Republicans who say that their top priority in the next 2 years is to defeat President Obama, they're as confused as goats on AstroTurf when it comes to understanding what their job is. Defeating someone doesn't mean that you win. So please accept my gift, a sense of responsibility. Then go out and do what's right for America and let the people sort out the politics for themselves. As for Obama, it's obvious that he needs the courage of his convictions. This is a gift that'll keep on giving. Think of it as Viagra for stiffening the political backbone, helping you stand tall for America's workaday people who really do need you standing firmly for them. And for all of you teabag Republicans who got elected to Congress by demonizing Obama's universal health care plan as big government socialism, how about a supersized box of political integrity? Since you oppose providing health coverage to everyone, surely you intend to include yourself by refusing to accept the socialized health care that you Congress critters get from us taxpayers. Take a dose of integrity, and you'll feel much better in the morning. This is Jim Hightower saying to all of my giftees, you're welcome.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Now it's time for that portion of the Illinois Labor Hour with Tom Thomas's brand new poem of the week, Revel in the Unity.
On the land, a silken blanket, lakes and streams are frozen over. Snowdrifts stretch across the fields that in summer host the clover. By the time the biting winter blanketed the fertile prairie, too many jobs were swept away, which for life were necessary. But there comes a time each winter when the darker days all brighten, when the stress of unemployment for one happy day can lighten. Another Christmas day has come. The earth is not a cinder, yet. Folks still look out for each other, even if presents they don't get. Every society on earth has a day like Christmas each year. Since the days of Saturnalia, it's a holiday all hold dear. Midwinter feasts have fed many. Each winter the holidays came. They have fed the hungry masses, no matter the faith they proclaim. Gather at your fires today, this day the world celebrates, and revel in the unity before the holiday abates. Revel in the Unity was written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois on December 21, 2010, and was first recited live Christmas Day, December 25, 2010, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Community Radio for East Central Illinois.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I've got, as far as public service announcements, I kind of wanted to do a little bit of a holiday readings, if you will, since usually around this time of year, people have a little extra time to do catch up on some reading. And this email is from a mutual friend of and comrade of Jim Iman, mine, John Ryman, in Oakland, California. He writes his email, comrades, here in the U.S., many Obama supporters, including his critical supporters, are shocked at the speed at which he has capitulated to the Republicans following the recent elections. I wrote the attached book review, which I also posted to a website to deal with this. It's a review of Robert Scheer's new book, The Great American Stick-Up. This book details how finance capital basically integrated itself into the administration of Clinton and Ford, with all other following presidents, including George W. Bush and Barack Obama. It was with all quote-unquote progressives, though. Scheer misses a couple of points, and he kind of goes into this a little bit, but he says, however, if you want a somewhat detailed account of who did what and how they personally profited from the deregulation of the financial industry, this book is well worth reading. And in that vein, I'd like to recommend a couple other good reads here. One of them is called The Obama Syndrome, written by a great author and political commentator that Jim and I really like a lot, Tariq Ali. And also another book, which I happened to get for Christmas yesterday evening, is called Hoodwinked by John Perkins, who's written a couple previous books. One was his first one, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And in fact, there's a film out, which you can see on Link TV and Free Speech Television occasionally, which is called An Apology of an Economic Hitman. And in this recent book he's released, Hoodwinked, it's basically an economic hitman reveals why the world financial markets imploded and what we need to do to remake them. So just a little few suggestions there on some good holiday reading. You got to know this stuff. I mean, even if you know kind of what's going on, you need to know details and facts, because believe me, brothers, sisters, friends, and comrades, when you're dealing with a lot of working class people out there that you're working with, it is amazing how many people that get all of their information from the corporate media, and I'm going to use the word, are brainwashed. I know that's a strong word. I might even be accused of being condescending by using it. But I'm telling you, people out there don't know all the facts. And this is why it's so important to support alternative media, everything from WFT radio and that we're here, also Public Access TV, which programs like that Jim Iman and I do, Labor's Worldview TV, and also you know, nationally with Link TV and Free Speech Television. Because, folks, you're not going to get the truth either from PBS or NPR, because that network, unfortunately, was compromised years ago when the federal government cut off their funding and they were required to go begging to all the corporate interests to get their money. And you can see the results. Good case in point is that the television show on PBS, Frontline. Great program it used to be back in the 1980s, but starting about the early 90s, that show just got so bad. I mean, it was no longer the great investigative journalist program it was. It was all, typically, pushing the corporate agenda. And I can't even stomach to watch it anymore. But Jim, this is probably a good way to bring you in now. You're a frequent listener of NPR, and you do, I guess, watch a little bit of PBS and stuff. Would you have any disagreements with what I said there?
Not at all, actually, David. In fact, don't forget, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, mm-hmm. manages this thing, and they are going to follow a corporate agenda. Further and further, they have become less independent and corporatized, and they have to be considered parts of mainstream corporate media.
Oh, Jim, can I throw something in here?
Sure.
Somebody just criticized me recently for using the term mainstream media. And,
yeah, I don't like that term either, but go ahead.
And I know we also use corporate, but I'm thinking, why don't we just really call it what it is and excludes PBS and NPR, that is, the capitalist media.
Oh, that's a good point.
I'm good with that.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Mainstream media is used by the mainstream, and that's why I use it, because people that are used right. to mainstream media have a good...
Well, it's got a nice ring to it, mainstream media, rather than...
Yeah, right.
Unlike but see, that us, implies that it's a majority opinion, which
that's
it's not.
True. Well, yeah. Right. If you look at the polls, the people of the United States amazingly are much farther to the left than the media that they attend to and the politicians that they elect.
Okay, let's do that. The capitalist media and the working class media.
Mm-hmm. Good.
All right.
Okay.
David Johnson even posed the question, why doesn't the AFL-CIO have its own channel?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I think the answer to that is quite simple, because it would be... It's very expensive, and we'd be taking money away from the Democratic Party, the capitalist Democratic Party, which funds it. And we got to give the money to the Democrats, because they're doing not quite as bad a job of screwing us as the Republicans are.
Here's a big problem with the AFL-CIO. Number one, they don't really have anything to say.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hi, we're still capitalists, but we're kind of against. Thing, or something.
Certain things, yeah.
Yeah, and then number two, they don't really need their own channel. There's plenty of outlets for them to use if they would just produce the content. For example, Free Speech Radio or Free Speech TV would love to have stuff coming from the unions. Link TV.
Mm-hmm.
There's also Al Gore's network.
Yes.
Current TV, right. Which is sort of a youth oriented network.
Yeah,
but
he wouldn't.
They could be putting stuff on.
Bill. Let's not forget, Al Gore was the main pusher behind getting NAFTA passed, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Well, yeah, I know those things, Dave. But I think that
he's no friend of
labor.
Well,
yeah, but I do think that. That could be available to them. But there's no argument that they could get on things like Free Speech TV.
Mm-hmm.
They could also put on a fairly economical campaign of getting things, DVDs, out to people with the local cable systems.
I agree. But here's
a program like that. Producing stuff is not that expensive.
I think that'd be a good first step. And, supporting more programs like ours, I mean, we get, one of our underwriters is the AFL-CIO Champaign County. And the thing is that we do have, and continue to criticize the national AFL-CIO all the time. And in fact, back in, when was it, 2000, 2001, when I was vice president of the local Central Labor Council, AFL-CIO, you and Peter Miller had me on the show, interviewed me, even though the Champaign County AFL-CIO was underwriting the program, you know.
Well, and then, you know, we have had a more recent situation where one of the local member unions of the Central Labor Council got upset about a little bit of a thing that we blew, that something that we covered that they didn't want to have covered.
Yes.
And our good friends there,
the GEO in particular,
us, mm-hmm. you know, and well, the NEA, who's not really even part of the AFL-CIO, and
right? But the
professors,
yes. Yeah. But here's the thing, though: I agree with everything you said as far as content and all that, but I still think there needs to be a regular news, a daily news program, just like CNN Headline News, that's put out by you know, the AFL-CIO or something, you know, basically a workers' news update every half hour to compete with that, because that's where most people get their news information. And Jim, what do you think?
Well, don't forget, mm-hmm. back in the 30s, WLS in Chicago was the voice of labor in Chicago.
Right. No, WCFL.
CFL
stands for Chicago Federation of Labor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. WLS stands for World's Largest Store.
Which is serious.
And WGN is the world's greatest newspaper.
Oh, not quite. But
WCFL. And The problem is when you get capitalist politics mixed in with a labor station,
mm-hmm.
you know, then you have to do the struggle between workers' interests and what the capitalist interests are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't do that, then you're going to go down the SHIT hole.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to become part of the capitalist class,
right.
and lose your labor identity.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been the history of labor media. The newspapers, for example, in Milwaukee. The Milwaukee Socialist Leader was the leading newspaper in Milwaukee for years, and even up and through the 1952. And they had pages in German. And, of course, it was infiltrated by the Democratic Party, and mm-hmm. finally they lost sales and...
Well, I'm sure they did their best to systematically sabotage it from the inside, just like the, you know, the gas, the oil, and rubber companies bought up, you know, the mass transit districts around the country, especially Los Angeles, and just ran them into the ground and used as an excuse to close them. You know,
right? You know, and men like, you know, Tom Hartman, who I listen to regularly because he has great talking points and he knows a lot.
That's right, folks. By the way, in this area, he's on from 11 until 2 p.m., and you can stream him live from his website, and it's just tomhartman.com, and he has that covered with almost any spelling you can imagine.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bill.
But anyway, you know, Hartman says, what we have to do is infiltrate the Democratic Party. Well, I think the Democratic Party not only infiltrated the labor movement,
mm-hmm.
but has infiltrated him. He has got to separate himself. I've been trying to get on the air
mm-hmm.
and tell him, you call yourself a socialist. Mm-hmm. How can you call yourself a socialist and want to infiltrate the Democratic Party? The Democratic Party has been attempted to be infiltrated by since the 19th century by the left. Mm-hmm. It hasn't worked out very well.
They always get co-opted is what happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, by the way, Dave, I wanted to bring up a couple other things.
Yes, uh-huh.
You can Google WCFL and come up with a whole bunch of cool things, mm-hmm. such as Larry Lujack's last show in 1976 on YouTube.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was looking for something. I can't find it, but I believe Bob McChesney wrote a book about WCFL.
Oh, yes. I think, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And I've read it, mm-hmm. but it was a few years ago, and I haven't quite found it yet. But there's a WCFL timeline here that I haven't looked at yet. Let me look. It might be pretty interesting because it started out. WCFL started out. It was a union thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was, it was all oriented towards workers' culture mm-hmm. in Chicago. And the WCFL of my memory as a child was basically kind of a top 40 radio station.
Well, see, that's kind of the superficial explanation of what happened to WCFL. The superficial explanation is that they started, the people, fewer and fewer people were listening to it. and that they had no choice but to go over and be primarily a top 40 and a sports-oriented
Yeah, I remember
station.
A lot of sports on
okay.
there.
Now, here's the thing is I take a difference with that. I think this is why it's so important to integrate workers' news with workers' culture. I think the entertainment has to be as an integral part of the information because, frankly, let's face it. I mean, you know, we have to be compelling out there. I mean, not just our message, but our method of our message. I mean, it has to be tied in. Culture is part of our, you know, our politics and our, you know, way of life, you know. So if it was done right, that's what I'm saying, is that, you know, labor media, nationwide labor media could work. And I think that right now, besides content, like you were suggesting, Bill, is that working people need a regular news digest every day to get them away from this corporate mind control, lies, distortions, and half-truths.
Yes, that is true. And in fact, I haven't done this for a long time, but one time I did go and I looked over PBS, mm-hmm. and there was like it was like, well, maybe 20 to, well, as a matter of fact, they had no labor show because mm-hmm. that was their policy, because somehow if you're a capitalist, you're not political.
Yeah, right.
But if you represent labor, you know, you are political. You're automatically political.
Mm-hmm.
So they would not run labor. Shoot. There was a show that's, anyway, that, I can't remember the name of the show. There was
was it Will Durst's show? Or?
Yeah, Will Durst's mm-hmm. show. There okay. was a show that would ran on several PBS stations, but PBS itself would not run it. And this local station here would not run it. And we actually had a little email war with Ellis Bromberg, who was the general manager of the local station.
That was you and Peter that was doing it?
Well, several people that we know.
Okay.
And it just, you know, it would be... We would get rid of it. Would help dispel so many commonplaces. And I mean, I can remember, Dave, I don't know, of course, Jim would be and Tom would be, and you're probably of enough age that you can remember, even up until the 1970s, there was a great respect for blue collar people.
Mm-hmm.
There would be, I don't know why I remember this, but I remember jokes in sitcoms where people would make a joke referring, oh, and we've got dental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, things like that. This is so great because they had dental insurance. There were jokes about the janitors in buildings making more than the white-collar workers in the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
There would often be just mentions of some kind of things about union strikes and so forth.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right, Bill. Even the television program, you know, the comedy shows were all working class. Now they're all middle class. Where is the working class? Well, we don't exist anymore. I mean, it's just this bad. And the middle class values involved here, which is serve yourself and screw your fellow worker, just were not present then. But that's what it is now.
Yes. Yeah, and see, I don't know. I haven't been watching much regular kind of TV for several years. But, I mean, even up through the – I mean, I can remember as a matter of fact, me and Jason were talking about this last week after the show. I remember the big WKRP two-part episode where they were thinking about joining the union and what was his name? Tim, the station manager, kind of the star of the show. He made some deal with the evil old lady that owned the station. It was like, is he going to have sex with her or what? But they didn't get the union. They didn't have the union.
Mm-hmm.
There was always every sitcom. And I think probably every dramatic series always had some type of union episode. Even Babylon 5, the science fiction series from the 90s, had an episode where the dock workers on the space station were going on strike. And the captain of the station, the commander, he was sympathetic to him, and he finally found a clause where he could help them out when the people on that ran the station were going to, like, I don't know, they were going to invoke some kind of law like the Taft-Hartley Act,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, throw them all out in space or something.
And you know what? I saw a big change just in general. I mean, from the – it was like right – it started right about 1981, 82. You know, like all through the 70s, you had shows like The Waltons, Little House on the Prairie, Laverne and Shirley – You get my drift here.
Right.
Shows about working class people. Happy come the come, yeah.
Well, Happy Days was pretty middle class, except for the Fonz.
Right. True. Anyway.
And that's why we have to remember there's middle income that's not necessarily middle class.
Yeah. And shows
All in the Family.
Exactly. And even shows that weren't necessarily about working class people like MASH were very anti-authoritarian, anti-establishment. And here comes 1981, which happens to coincide with what? The election of Ronald Reagan and the advent of the New
Dallas.
Right. Dallas, Dynasty, Falcon Crest, all these shows glamorizing the wealthy in the ruling class, and all these other shows about working people being just cut left and right. I mean, that's when all those shows went off the air, the Waltons, you know, all those.
Yeah, and look at movies. You go back, of course, the 30s and so on and so forth, but you get into the 1950s, which is an incredibly interesting time. In television, you had Jackie Gleason.
Mm-hmm.
My golly.
The Honeymooners.
Yes, it's amazingly. Yeah, I mean, their apartment was so bleak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like a coffee, you know, just a couple of but anyway, but then you had these bizarre movies like, Never Steal Anything Small, which I would love to find a DVD copy of.
Uh-huh.
It was a Jimmy Cagney musical.
Uh-huh.
And he loved being in musicals. And what it was, he was a corrupt dock worker. And I just remember one scene. I saw this on the early show when I was a kid. And I remember this one scene. They were having an election for the union local, and the people that he thought would vote, they were doing it on a boat. And when the people came on that they thought would vote against him, well, his guys would just hit him on the head and throw him off the boat. And then they'd have these big scenes where they're singing a song going, "Never steal anything small." I mean, it was really strange.
Yeah.
And then
sounds like it.
Then have you ever heard of The Pajama Game?
No.
Does that sound like a labor movie?
No.
What it was a Doris Day Rock Hudson movie. Doris Day was organizing the pajama factory that Rock Hudson ran.
You're kidding.
No. Then you had all the, you know, just things. Yeah, I'm getting excited.
Okay, listen, we got to go to the song that you brought, Bill, the 1913 Massacre. It's about a union event, basically the massacre of a bunch of union workers during a Christmas party. And I want that to lead into one of our topics of the show that Jim came on today. Was talking a little about middle-class values in Christmas. So,
By the way, Dave, let me set this up a little bit more. And this is from the 1913massacre.com, which is people who were making a documentary about this. And I did an interview with them in 2005, which you can find on radioforall.net. And they're talking about it. On that fateful day, the striking miners of Calumet, their wives and children, about 500 people at all, were gathered in Italian Hall. And this is Calumet, Michigan, a copper mining area.
Okay.
Okay, for a holiday party held on the second floor at the top of a steep fairway. After the festivities had begun, someone, to this day no one knows who, yelled fire. Despite efforts to keep the hall under control, panic took hold of the crowd. The miners, their wives, and children made a mad rush for the stairs. In the ensuing chaos, 74 people were crushed and suffocated to death on the stairway of Italian Hall. 59 of the dead were children. There was no fire.
Wow.
It's thought that the copper boss's thugs yelled that.
Wow. Well, good.
And blocked the door at the bottom of the stairs.
Bill, thanks for that setup. That did a lot more justice than I ever could give to it.
Well,
so.
I'm reading, so.
Okay. Well, here we go. 1913 Massacre, and we'll be right back.
Take a trip with me in 1913. Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, where the miners are having a big Christmas ball. I'll take you through a door and up stairs, where laughing and singing can be heard everywhere. I let you shake hands with the people that you meet. And watch the kids dance round big Christmas tree. Where you ask about work and you ask about pay. Tell you they make less than a dollar a day. Working their copper claims and risking their lives. So it's fun to spend Christmas with the children and the wife. Well, the little girl sits down by the Christmas tree light. Play the piano, so you gotta be quiet. You hear all this fun you would not realize. That the copper boss, the man or melon outside. Well, the copper boss, the sticks his head in the door. And one of them yelled and screamed, there's a fire. A lady, she hollered, there is no such a thing. Keep on with your party, 'cause there's no such a thing. Well, a few people rushed, but it was only a few. It's just the scabs and the thugs fooling you. A man grabbed his daughter and he carried her down. But the thugs held the door. Could not get out.
Okay, we're back, and just looking to see who was the performer on that, and it looks like it was Michael Picasa, I think it was, but that was a 1913 massacre. Okay, Jim, you want to talk a little bit about the whole Christmas holiday, as well as middle class values that you kind of touched on.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
How it's been detrimental to the working class.
Right. Okay. Well, let's start with the fact that we have Christmas on this date because the Romans, under Constantine, in their wisdom, decided to make the Greek goddess Mithra's celebration Christmas Day. And, of course, the Catholic Church was always very good at this. They would take all the pagan holidays and, you know, make them into Christian holidays.
Mm-hmm. They sort of were co-opting long before Marx coined the term.
I would say very good, Bill. I like that. Before we get into middle-class values, let's try to find something that we can get optimistic about.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a hard time.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, we're talking about Paul Street, or we were talking about Obama earlier.
Yeah.
Somebody to Google would be Paul Street, mm-hmm, from Chicago, and one of his books is The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power, or so mm-hmm on. He's a very stringent left-wing critic of Barack Obama.
Yeah, he was here in Champaign not too long ago, in fact.
But back to middle-class values.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to what's optimistic.
Yes.
We're told that sales are up something like 8.1% over the holidays. Oh, this is just great, you know. And what's really happening, what the sales that are really up, according to John Fugel saying yesterday on Grit, is that the major thing that all the sales are up in is pornography and illegal drugs.
Oh, by the way, is that Grit TV?
Yeah.
With Laura Flanders, right, folks. Definitely Google that. It is a great show.
Yeah.
So, anyway, all right. Sales aren't up.
Well, I thought the holiday shopping, well, I mean, everybody's going to Spencer Gifts or something and buying kind of kinky stuff instead of.
Well, you know, But it's the pretense of middle class values is why we do this, you know. And Fugelsang also said that, I mean, isn't it kind of odd that we have Christmas where you buy all these material goods to celebrate a man who is opposed to material goods and material wealth? I mean, it's a total contradiction.
Yeah.
You know, so, but anyway, yeah, the more we have, you know, middle class values, we can measure by how much stuff we have.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't been able to get a lot of stuff lately. But now we've got a little bit of more money as a result of some subsidies. And, you know, and well, it's okay that the bottom 25, 30% of Americans have got a tax increase because the middle class and the bourgeoisie have gotten great tax reductions.
Right. They're losing the, what is it called, the making work something.
I don't know.
Exemption or something.
Earned income tax credit, perhaps?
Making employment work or something. Mm-hmm. It was like some kind of tax thing that they had where you got to pay less. I don't know. Because I didn't qualify for it, I guess is why I don't know about it. But anyway, that's what's being lost, and that's why the taxes are going up.
Well, that sounds like
on.
The earned income tax credit, which was
basically. No, it wasn't the earned income tax. It's called something like making work pay, and it was another credit.
Okay.
But it wasn't the earned income tax
okay.
credit, I don't believe.
Okay.
Yeah, so, well, getting, you know, if we say middle class values is serve yourself and screw your fellow worker, it's the bourgeoisie are philanthropists in a way, because once they're rich enough to give stuff away, they build libraries and museums and do all kinds of great things. The middle class can't afford that luxury.
Mm-hmm.
They would love to be bourgeois.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, do the workers want to be middle class? The middle, yes. Does the middle class want to be bourgeois? Yes. Sorry, everybody, but it just can't happen that way. You know, if we have a classless society, it's got to be downward, not upward.
Well, they also, too, do you want to, there's a billion Chinese and about almost another billion people in India who would like to be middle class and bourgeois, and unfortunately it appears this planet cannot support that.
Well, that's true.
So I think we got to make a distinction here. I mean, you know, just the term middle class has a lot of misconceptions because, in fact, a lot of it's promoted by our own union leadership. You know, I think it was back probably to Jimmy Hoffa maybe before about how, you know, we wanted, you know, we're going to, the working class is going to enter the middle class and we're not leaving. And I think he primarily referred to, at that, when he made those statements, the income levels. However, Jim's differed with me on that. He basically thinks that it was part also promoting the middle class lifestyle. I mean, one thing I've seen though is this society through the corporate media is great at this. Is that they try to propagate the myth that we live in basically a classless society, that we don't have a caste system, that there's no classes, and that everybody's middle class, and only a few screw ups are poor. You know?
You're of course right. Now, the great genius of Henry Ford is that he realized if he could get the automobile into every worker's hands, make it cheap enough for them to get it, and still keep unions out of Ford Motor Company, then we would start to feel like, well, we've got a horse. I mean, if you look in the 19th century up to the car, the horse was your way of freedom.
When she posted that?
It was the most important and most sought after and worshipped thing among slaves in the 19th century was the horse. The music was the horse and buggy rhythms. The horse was your method of freedom.
Yeah.
Then it became the car what was your method of freedom.
Yeah, man, but you know what a car is? It's rock and roll. That's
You know, Bill just pointed out something to me. He saw something that my wife posted 2 hours ago that relates to this subject. I'm shocked, frankly. Go ahead and read it, Bill.
Okay, this is on Facebook. Our dear friend Sandra, who many of the listeners know, she's a great person. Dave's wife, Heidi. And this is Sandra's, her status update is, this year my heart feels more open to the spirit of Christmas than it ever has before, and I sense it in everyone. Do you think the world seems a little more loving than it has in the past? I said, not at all. Okay. Look. But anyway, Dave's wife, Heidi, here says, I saw nothing but frustration at the stores this year. People wanting to buy nice things, but not able to. I heard parents discussing their money situation, debating if they can swing at buying one more thing. I've never heard these conversations before. Very sad, all caps. I can't say I saw any loving, and believe me, I look hard. And knowing Heidi, I know she does. And my, so, yeah, it was just, yeah,
so even
what
a
you're saying.
Relatively prosperous community like this with the university, you know, most people, a lot of people in this community having halfway decent jobs or very decent jobs at the university, it's still that way. Interesting. But, yes, Jim, I mean, you know, when you, everyone, I mean, the thing is that the wealthy, I mean, there's so much money out there. If basically, you know, the wealth was basically taken away from these wealthy people to the point to where they still had a very comfortable income, we would have enough. Basically, everybody in the United States would have health care, free education all the way through the university, and living
social security, definitely.
Yeah, and living wages. I mean, basically enough to comfortably live.
We can't have that.
Redistributing
the wealth. To redistribute the wealth is absolutely out. It's going to take us to redistribute the wealth. They will not do
it. Well, of course not.
It's getting farther and farther and farther apart. In fact, it hasn't been this far apart since the 19th century.
Yes.
I mean, it is absolutely amazing. So,
what do you mean by we can't do that? Of course we could do that. If
no, well, we can't redistribute the wealth unless we take
we have
state
control
power to
yes,
do it.
Yes, and I don't want to stop there. I basically want to I mean, to me, my holiday wish is to redistribute, basically to restructure the entire system and do away with capitalism. I mean, because, you know, a lot of people also, there's some more ambiguities there. The difference between capitalism and, let's say, what Tom Thomas calls free enterprise. What Tom calls free enterprise is basically what's existed since the dawn of civilization, which is the exchange of goods and services amongst people.
We can have a non-capitalist.
That's not capitalism.
A non-capitalist basic market society. Capitalism did not occur until around the 17th and 18th centuries. Before that, you had feudalism. I don't know if how the Romans stacked up in these definitions as far as being capitalists. As
okay, I think Jim's going
to
enlighten us. He's okay, done a lot, of, studying on this.
Well, what I wanted to say was that getting back to middle-class values in America, and I agree with Bill on feudalism and capitalism, is that it was the automobile that instilled the fact that if you had an automobile and you had freedom to travel and weren't stuck in the house, that you were middle class. That is the measurement. And Uncle Dave Macon, back in 1924, wrote a song called Jordan and My Hard Road to Travel, and I'll do my best to sing you one verse. Well, I don't know, but I think I'm right. The auto remand the country. Well, let's go back to the horse and the buggy and to try to raise some money. Haul off your overcoat to roll up your sleeves. Jordan and my hard road to travel. Well, haul off your overcoat to roll up your sleeves. Jordan and my hard road to travel, I believe. Well, Jordan and my hard road to travel, fellow workers.
Yep. Well, there's another thing about the effect of the automobile, and I'm really wondered for years and years and years I'd read about all these great strikes and organizing campaigns long before we had telephones and radios and internets and all of that. And I always wondered how that happened, and we can't get, you know, two people together, it seems like, anymore. And what it was everybody lived within pretty much, I'm sure, walking distance of the place where they worked because they couldn't drive there. Meanwhile, I work with people that live 60 miles away from me on a regular basis. We don't go to the same bars. We don't go to the same churches. We don't go to the same grocery stores. Our families don't gather and talk about these things, and we have no class consciousness.
And most cases, you don't even know who your neighbors are. You maybe say hello to them once in a while.
There's two people that there's only one. There's one house across the road from me out on this highway. I don't know who these people are. They haven't come over to talk to me. I went over to talk to them. We don't work in the same place. I don't know which way they turn when they go out to drive, but I head over here. You know,
That is a missing component, I suppose. I mean, here the internet has, tremendous organizing capabilities, but the main component is the community that's missing. I mean, our community, because this is what the ruling class wants. They want us to go to work, come home, get in front of the television, and don't socialize or have any kind of community involvement unless it's church on Sunday.
This is the real danger of the internet. It's virtual community.
Right.
That's true.
Virtual communication.
Right. We're sitting here, typing back and forth about stuff and instead of being out on a street. But, of course, it could get us out there if we would just do it. I don't know.